So one of the biggest stories to come out of the news cycle the past couple of months that hopefully hasn't been just shrouded over by a lot of other distractions in the news cycle has been the decision, if you remember, of Amazon, you know, the big company, to pull out of New York City. All right, so there was that big hoopla, where is Amazon going to go with its second headquarters, and then, you know, all this red carpet and everything. I confess, like, I couldn't help myself following this story. I mean, when you tell me that one of the biggest companies ever is going to start a second headquarters, all right, one just as massive as the first, I start to pay attention. Okay, so a decision like this, it means jobs, obviously. A decision like this means infrastructure. It means a whole ton of money. It means something like what we saw, 200 cities, I think was the count. 200 cities were rolling out the red carpet to wine and dine Jeff Bezos, which is the CEO of Amazon, all right? Of course, we were one of them, all right? The Dayton, Cincinnati metropolitan area. You know, what was it going to be? Our new corporate America, I think, or something like this, right? That was the big hope. I remember then when Amazon chose New York and Washington, D.C. For not just one, but two brand new headquarters, all right? And I asked, what in the world was that all about? Was Amazon not the king of commerce enough? Now they had to go with something like the Holy Trinity of headquarters or something. How do you have three heads? And then I thought, well, I'm Christian, so I guess that's God right there. Of course, things fell apart. They started to fall apart in New York, at least, pretty fast, right? They started to fall apart pretty fast. A bunch of folks in New York began to wonder whether a big corporate giant like Amazon could ever really have their best interests at heart. It took something, if you were following the numbers, it took something like $3 billion in tax incentives from the city to get Amazon to New York in the first place. And it seems like everyone seemed a bit worried that even 50,000 jobs, even that couldn't... It wouldn't be enough, because most of these jobs wouldn't be going to the average daily New Yorker, right? This wouldn't be happening. Instead, it would just bring in all these brand new, out-of-town folks, these high-skilled, high-tech folks, and then that would drive, the concern was, the housing prices even higher and make the congestion even worse in New York. So the question was, how is Amazon actually going to help the people in Queens? How is that going to help? So in the end, a group got together and they petitioned and they decided that it wasn't going to help, and Amazon chose not to fight that fight and they pulled out. Well, I was thinking about this whole Amazon pulling out this past week, and then I picked up an article, and it asked a simple question, one simple question. It seemed to be a question that was missing from all the discussion, all the news of the past few months. And it was just this: who really needed Amazon the most? Who really needed Amazon the most? Did New York? Does DC? Of all the cities that rolled out that red carpet, how many of them actually needed the investment that Amazon would bring? I'd say it's probably a little self-serving to say that Dayton, Cincinnati did, but what about Detroit? What about Cleveland? All right, this is the center of the Rust Belt. Detroit, Cleveland, Indianapolis, Dayton, Cincinnati, all right? Ever since Amazon decided to build this second or third headquarters to start this bidding war, there's been a lot of talk about who wanted the company the most, who wanted them. But what didn't get talked about was who actually needed it. Certainly not at a national level. Who needed it? Who needed Amazon to come in and help them out the most? And I think that's the real question. That's the real question. The reason why I think that's the real question is simple. It's because not every city is the same. You're probably like, yeah, duh. Not every city's the same. I get that. Yeah, mind reader. Right, right. So if you look at New York and D.C., if you toss a bunch of shiny new tech jobs at New York and D.C. into this already super expensive housing market, all right, this inflated housing market, Wait, I think that's right. Then what happens is the price of those homes goes up even more. The price of rent, the price of the homes, it makes it even more difficult for your everyday New Yorker to afford to live in their own city. This is what we call gentrification, right? You know this word, gentrification. So the question is, would the extra income that Amazon brings to the everyday lower-skilled worker who's already living there in New York, say if Jeff Bezos decides one, you know, Tuesday afternoon that he wants a hot dog from your hot dog stand down there in Queens, he comes to your hot dog stand and he gets you, you know, this one extra hot dog a week or something like this, is that extra income going to offset all the other miscellaneous costs you'd have to pay to bring Amazon in, right? That's a good question, right? This is the question people started to ask. It's a pretty easy answer when you look at Detroit or Cleveland. The cost of living in these places is rock bottom, right? You could throw 50,000 jobs in Dayton, just in Dayton tomorrow, and it's probably not going to move the dial one little tick. So why did a rich city like New York win in the first place? Well, maybe I'm wrong, but I have to think it's because New York could afford it. It seems that the sort of irony in all of this is that the cities that maybe needed Amazon's corporate investment the most are precisely those cities that could least afford it. They couldn't afford to dish out all the tax incentives and the other things that the company wanted. So what really is the problem here? What's the problem? I think it's this. I think we assume that Amazon was interested in helping cities out. I don't think we can assume that Amazon is interested in actually helping cities out. Amazon is not altruistic, all right, by nature. What Amazon wants is tax breaks. It sells promises of corporate investment for tax breaks. There's nothing surprising or really necessarily wrong with this, right? Amazon is looking for what it would consider a win-win. All right, so are these other cities. But the people who we would think would need to win the most don't stand a chance of winning at all. If you had to boil it down to one word, I like to think of it as Amazon not paying attention. Amazon's not really paying attention to who actually needs them the most. The company's not all that concerned about attending to the city's needs. It's more interested in looking out for its own. You'd probably say that's just smart business, and I agree with you, right? If you're looking to profit, that's the best way to go about it, all right? Everything is filtered through what's best for the company. But just because it's what's best for the company doesn't mean it's what's best for everybody else, for the world. Doesn't mean that it's good. So this week, what I want to talk about is that one word that I think Amazon was missing. I want to talk about attention. Attention. Our text for today, I think, is all about attention. It's a story about two refugees, really. Hagar and Ishmael, a mother and a son. And if you're like, how are they refugees? Just hang on a minute. It's about how God attends to Hagar and Ishmael. If you remember, Hagar is an Egyptian servant. In fact, she was probably a slave. She served Abraham's wife, Sarah, and Ishmael was her son. The beginning of the story is like a really sad daytime soap opera that's gone wrong, all right? It's pretty crazy. Sarah knows she's way past the time when she can have kids. So she tells Abraham, her husband, to sleep with her servant Hagar so that she might have a kid through Hagar instead. This is a strange take on surrogate pregnancy, by the way. Bad idea. Okay, so even if this type of relationship wasn't all that uncommon back then, and apparently it wasn't, all right, I think we can see how it could turn sour pretty quick, right? And it does. When Hagar gets pregnant, Sarah gets jealous and ashamed, and so she treats Hagar so badly that she runs away into the desert. The baby isn't even born yet, so I've got to think she's miserable, thirsty, possibly lost in this desert, all right? And this is where, finally, you're probably still wondering, we get to our passage for today. It's Genesis chapter 16, verses 7 through 14. Here's how it goes. The angel of the Lord found Hagar by a spring of water. Thank goodness, right? By a spring of water in the wilderness, the spring that was on the way to Shur. And the angel said, "Hagar, slave girl of Sarah, where have you come from and where are you going?" She said, "I am running away from my mistress Sarah." The angel of the Lord said to her, "Return to your mistress and submit to her." Then the angel of the Lord also said, "I will so greatly multiply your offspring that they cannot be counted." And the angel of the Lord said to her again, "Now you have conceived and shall bear a son. You shall call him Ishmael, for the Lord has given heed to your affliction. He shall be a wild donkey of a man, with his hand against everyone, and everyone's hand against him, and he shall live at odds with all his kin." So she gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her. So Hagar gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her: "You are El Roy." For she said, "I have now seen the one who sees me." Therefore, the well was called Beer Lahoy Roy. It lies between Kadesh and Bered. There's a lot in this passage we could talk about. Why did God send Hagar back into that situation? God needed a little counseling on his counseling, we might think. All right? Or just what did he mean saying Ishmael would grow up to be a wild donkey? What's going on here? Well, what is all this? We could spend weeks, I think, unpacking this passage, but I think what we really want to focus on today here is its use of names. Names. I remember when Sarah and I were talking about what we were going to name Marty. All right, we wanted to name him something that meant something, that had this history to it. All right, a story of some sort. So we decided to name him Martin. Martin was my dad's middle name, and my dad had died a few months before that. And so we thought, well, how best than to honor the memory of this guy that my son will never meet, his grandfather, right? We'll name him Martin. And then we thought, well, we also really like Sarah's dad, and since we don't want to play favorites, we'll name him Reed, which is my father-in-law's middle name. So we took my dad's middle name and Sarah's dad's middle name, and we put them together, and we get Martin Reed. And so same sort of thing we did with Emma. Her middle name is Ruth, and that's my mother's middle name and my mother-in-law's middle name. And so we lucked out there pretty well. And so we definitely covered all our bases and are expecting higher quantities of cash at Christmas. So there's that, all right? So compared to ancient Hebrew culture, though, all right, what we did with Emma and Marty's names is really just child's play. When you read through the Bible, when you read through it, you start to see that all these little stories about all these so-called places that people rename. They call them something special because God showed up there, or there was a big battle there, or two people made a covenant there, or something like this. A couple weeks ago, when we were talking about Abraham taking Isaac up onto the mountain in order to sacrifice Isaac, you remember this story maybe? And so God tells, once they get up to the mountain, Abraham's about to put the knife into Isaac, and God says, "Stop! Don't kill your son." Instead, what does God do? He says, there's a ram that's got its horns stuck in the thicket. Go get that thing and sacrifice that instead. And Abraham is so thankful that God provided the ram that he sacrifices the ram, and then he renames the mountain, the entire mountain. He says, "This is going to be Jehovah Jireh. The Lord will provide." That's the name of the mountain. Because on this mountain, God provided the ram for the sacrifice. It's not just the names of places, though, that we find in the Bible. It's also the names of people. Abraham. We've been reading through, you've been following, you might be like, "Jason, it actually says Abram here when it should be Abraham." You're saying, "Abraham, what's the deal?" Well, in a story within the Abraham and Sarah stories, we get this change of name. And God says, "Abram, no longer are you going to be Abram. Now I'm going to call you Abraham. I'm going to call you Abraham. So Abram meant exalted father. And God says, I'm going to change it to Abraham, which means the father of a whole bunch of people. It's supposed to be this sort of reminder to Abraham that God has made this promise to him, that he's going to make Abraham into this great nation of people, one as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. So names, super important. My favorite set of names actually comes from the book of Ruth. All right, second time we talk about Ruth today, and we're not even talking about Ruth. And so Ruth is a great book. At the beginning of it, we find out that Naomi, one of the main characters, this is Ruth's mother-in-law, has two sons. Their names are Mahlon and Chilion. All right? If you were reading this story in the original Hebrew, you'd have thought, well, these guys aren't going to last very long. And you'd be right. It kind of gives away the surprise their names do. That's because their names are this. Mahlon means sick. And Chilion means weak. So you begin this, and you have Naomi has two sons, Sicky and Weaky, and they go into this foreign place. And by verse 5, they're dead. And you're like, well, that was easy. Saw that one coming. All right? So all in all, don't name your kids Mahlon and Chilion. All right? That's part of the story. All right? I think we get out of that. And of course, Naomi also makes a name change. Right, loses her kids, she loses her husband, all these people, and she goes, don't ever call me Naomi anymore. Instead, call me what? Do y'all remember? Mara. Naomi meant pleasant. She's like, I'm not pleasant, I'm Mara, I'm bitter. That's what Mara means, bitter. So she was one unhappy mother. You can understand why. Right, but back to the story of Hagar and Ishmael. When the Bible uses names like this, it's not just to give them historical significance, all right? Sometimes, a lot of times, in fact, that's not really their purpose at all. The Bible uses names like this because it wants them to have theological significance. It wants them to make a point, even in their very names. Just take the name Jesus, for example. Jesus isn't just a random name. All right? Jesus means God saves. It's kind of on the nose, right? Kind of on the nose. Jesus is the Greek pronunciation of the name Joshua in Aramaic. So not only does Jesus' name highlight his, what we'd call his reason for being, all right, and why he becomes human to die and rise again, it makes an important theological connection back to another Joshua. The Joshua of the Old Testament who helps the Israelites enter into the promised land, escape slavery in Egypt, and get to basically heaven, right? Be saved. The Bible is trying to tell us that this Jesus is a lot like the guy who saved all of your ancestors from slavery in Egypt. The point is that there's theology like this happening all the time in the Bible, just with the use of names. Just with the use of names and the people that are there and the places that are there and what they call them, which makes our story for today really interesting, I think, and pretty important. For starters, the name that God gives to Ishmael is loaded with meaning. Ishmael means God hears. God hears. When we realize this, I think all of a sudden, this passage, things start to pop. We start to figure it out. It's all about what God hears and what God sees. It's all about what God pays attention to. There's that word again, attention. He pays attention to two outcasts, two refugees named Hagar and Ishmael. God attends to them, we could say. In the context of the bigger Abraham and Sarah story that we're in, we realize that Hagar and Ishmael were cast off, left to die by the very people, all right, who are supposed to be a blessing to everybody around them. But God doesn't leave them out to dry. God doesn't leave them out to dry. God hears their cries for help. He names Ishmael Ishmael because he wants us to know that the blessing he promised Abraham really and truly and literally is for all people. every single person on earth. By calling Ishmael, Ishmael, a light bulb is supposed to go off in our heads. We're supposed to realize that God hears even those who are least important. If you look at the text, this is what Hagar realizes too. You are El Roy, she says. You're El Roy. That's what she names God. Not just because she sees him, but because he sees her. She sees the God who sees her. She gives him the name El Roy. God has looked at her very real and dire situation. She's pregnant, lost in the desert, no home, no future to speak of, cast out from the whole father of her child and the family. And he listens. He hears. He sees. And he acts. You see, names in the Bible, what they so often do is they get at the nature of a thing. They get at its character. God is El Roy, the one who sees. God is Ishmael, the one who hears. What we see here and throughout the Old Testament is this. All we have to do is cry out to God, and he'll hear us. Humble yourselves and trust in him, we're told, and he'll see you. God will hear you. He'll attend to you in your deserts and in your wildernesses. God is Ishmael El Roy, the one who hears and sees. If my people who are called by my name, we read later on, humble themselves, pray, seek my face, turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven. I will forgive their sin. I will heal their land, and my eyes will be open and my ears attentive to the prayer that is made. That's what God says to Solomon in 2 Chronicles. It's echoed all the way across the Old Testament. Deep down, if you want to know what the covenant with God is all about, this is it. God hears us. God sees us, and he responds. He loves, he blesses, he pays attention to what's really needed in the world, in our world, and he acts. But there's a catch. There's a catch. The covenant doesn't just go in one direction. It's not unidirectional. It goes both ways. God is named El Roy, but Hagar's son is also named. He's named virtually the same thing, Ishmael. What we find in this passage is not just a name that says something about who God is, it's a name that says something about who we are too. What God pours into us, we pour out again. God's not the only one who hears and sees. We do that too. This is why Ishmael is named Ishmael. God's character becomes our character. What we're given by God is meant to be given back to others. That's what's wrapped up in all that talk about Abraham and Sarah being a blessing to the nations. And God's not talking about some, what we might say, primordial type of trickle-down effect where the wealth just happens to bleed out into our neighbors. He's talking about intention. Better yet, he's talking about attention. We're not just Ishmael because God hears us. We're Ishmael because we hear others too. And we bless them with the same blessing that we've received. That's the promise of God here in this passage. We aren't just blessed to be delivered and saved by God. We're blessed to be a blessing. Blessed to be a blessing to our neighbors by being attentive to them, to their needs. We hear them. We see them. We attend to them. We're Ishmael. That's the heart of the Christian life. It's the heart of holiness. If you want to know what we're supposed to invest in, we've been talking about investment, right? If you want to know what we're supposed to invest in, once we've divested ourselves of ourselves, then we invest in attention. First and foremost, we pay attention. Sometimes I think when we talk about what it takes to live a holy life, we can get bogged down a little bit. We start focusing on a certain set of rules, right? We say, what else do I need to divest? And we look at these rocks, and I tell you, you're going to have to put it back down every week. And you're like, oh goodness, this never ends. It's asymptotic. If you weren't here last week, that's what we talked about, asymptotes. All right. We see this checklist of what is right and wrong, and we wonder how we can ever measure up to that checklist. I'm afraid this whole thing with the rocks has a tendency to become like that checklist and leads us down that kind of thinking about the holy life. But what we can learn from the passage today is that if God is El Roy, the one who sees, if God is Ishmael, the one who hears, that the Christian life isn't really about following a set of rules. It has much more to do with paying attention. We pay attention to what's outside of us, to what's really going on in the people around us, to the real needs that are there. And then we ask ourselves how we can help those folks out. How can we attend to them? God is always on the lookout for the needs around him. That's how he found you. That's how he found me. He was attending to the world. My brother defines sin as, in essence, not hurting people. Not hurting people. It has an outward focus, right? John Dick likes to use the phrase FANAFI. 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 All right? Find a need and fill it. FANAFI. Find a need and fill it. I think that sort of sums up the moral life. Find a need and fill it. What are the needs around you? Attend to them and then look for more. There's always going to be more. So as we enter into this time of reflection in a second, let's stop dwelling on our weaknesses. Start directing our attention to others. And after a while, I think we'll be able to look down. We'll realize that by doing that, by talking about FANAFI, we'll be walking the path of holiness. And we didn't even know it.